Hello everyone, my name is Juan Erasmus and this is the Good Friday message for the Aluach 2020, 10th of April. And let me just tell you that we are going to have four of the events. This is going to be a meditation this morning. Tomorrow we're going to have another meditation called The Silence of the Grave or The Silence of Burial. And then on Sunday we'll have two live streamed services, one conducted by André van Zyl, who is a friend of the Aluach and just a very sharp thinker himself. And in the evening, I will be reflecting on the surprise of the resurrection. Now, this message is probably coming to you on the back of a global death toll reaching up to 100,000 people and the infection reaching close to 2 million. Also, our president, Cyril Ramaphosa, yesterday announced that our lockdown will be continued by another 2 weeks. And the effects that this will have on the globe, on the economy in this country is just very, very dire. And many economists are projecting our economy shrinking up to 6%. I was in the township this past week delivering food parcels. And let me just also take this opportunity to really thank everybody who's given so generously to that. It's really humbling to see people giving in a time of scarcity. I think that's when we really show our characters, when we are up against the ropes and things are tough, then we give. And when we do that, I really think it's just such an awesome testimony. But I can tell you that the need is great, and that especially with this lockdown being continued for another 2 weeks, people are really going to struggle. And many people are estimating that we're going to lose up to 500,000 jobs because of it. And it's going to take us a very long time to recover from this pandemic. But the one thing that we do know is that South Africa is not isolated in this. This is a global thing. The world is in this together. And the economy is such a small consideration if you consider the human life that is, the human lives that's at stake here. But a pandemic it is. And when you have a pandemic and when you have a crisis situation of this scale, something that we haven't had in such a long time, then you have many people trying to give you answers, trying to make sense of this. People in the secular world and people in the church. And I read an article in the light of this that I found very interesting, especially the title. It's by the well-known theologian N.T. Wright, and it appeared in Time magazine not long ago. And the title is, "Christianity Offers No Answers About the Coronavirus." Now, that is a very provocative title. And N.T. Wright is a top theologian. He teaches, I think, at the University of Oxford at the moment, and he is a prolific academic. The books he writes are huge. They can just be used as weapons in your spare time, whether theological weapons or physical weapons. They're just huge. So he's a prolific academic, but also a conservative thinker. He believes in the resurrection. And do he believe in the resurrection? He wrote a book on it, The Resurrection of the Son of God, and that thing is just huge. So it's interesting when he writes an article called "Christianity Offers No Answers About the Coronavirus." And in this article, he points out that we have been subject to rationalism. Rationalism still dominates our thinking. So he actually laments that this post-enlightenment world in which we live, where we try to explain everything. So here's a pandemic, and now we want to explain it yet again. And he says this is actually just reductionism. We reduce everything to its parts and then try to explain it. There's no mystery involved. And this is just part of this enlightenment optimism, and dare I say, this enlightenment arrogance. Now, unfortunately, Christians try to play the same game. We are also the ones trying to explain what is going on, and we've seen just all sorts of silly explanations all over the place with regards to the COVID-19 pandemic. You have crazy preachers, and unfortunately I've been sent many of their messages blaming this whole pandemic on 5G. Who knew that 5G, some sort of mobile thing, will be blamed for the coronavirus? And they do not stop there. They think that this is part of this massive conspiracy theory that will just herald the new Antichrist that's on its way. We've just seen so many versions of the end times being forced down our throats. other people claim that this is God's punishment for us abandoning the Levitical laws in Wuhan. Not that I think that the people in Wuhan have ever not abandoned the Levitical laws. So we've just seen all sorts of strange and silly attempts at explaining this pandemic. And even at the Aluach, we've tried to make sense of it. But what if sometimes you don't? You don't get to make sense of it. Instead, what you do is you do something that biblical people have been doing for centuries. And that is, you lament. You cry. You ask the question why, but you don't get an answer. It's almost a why with an exclamation mark, not a why with a question mark. Now, as I said, the biblical tradition is just so rich in terms of its lament. In Psalm 10, verse 1, we read, "Lord, why do you stand so far away? Why do you hide in times of trouble? Lord, why do you stand so far away? Why do you hide in times of trouble?" I mean, the Psalms are full of it. In Psalm 13, we read, "Lord, how long will you continue to forget me? How long will you hide your face from me?" It's not only people who lament in the Bible, it's also God. You have God lamenting humanity and our broken relationship. But in the Christian story, this reaches its climax in the cross. Before that, you have Jesus weeping at the tomb of Lazarus, yes. You have that terrible scene in the Garden of Gethsemane, absolutely. But on the cross, we have this lament. The God-man, Jesus, lamenting. And I want to read to you from Mark 15, verse 33. It goes like this. "When it was noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 PM. And at 3, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, 'Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani,' which is translated, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?' When some of those standing there heard this, they said, 'Look, he's calling for Elijah.' Someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, fixed it on a reed, offered him a drink and said, 'Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down.' But Jesus let out a loud cry and breathed his last. Then the curtain in the sanctuary was split in two from top to bottom. When the centurion, who was standing opposite him, saw the way he breathed his last breath, he said, 'Surely this man was the Son of God.'" Now, Jesus knew that he was going to die. He talked about it continuously, almost very stoically. He spoke about his intention to die. We have this very famous scene where Peter confesses Jesus's identity, and then Jesus says, "Now I have to go to Jerusalem. I have to go and die." And Peter rebukes him, and then Jesus rebukes Peter. He was just very intentional, and like I said, almost very stoic about going to die. And then, as he goes to Jerusalem, and he's in Jerusalem, we have that terrible scene in the Garden of Gethsemane, where it almost seems as if he's flustered. He's not sure that this is the way that the story must end. And then on the cross, we have this proper lament. Why have you forsaken me? Now, many point out, rightly so, that Jesus is quoting Psalm 22. And in Psalm 22, it is resolved. In Psalm 22, God does eventually hear his servant. He does hear the cry of the distressed. Fair enough. But there's no way getting around this, that Jesus felt a sense of abandonment on the cross. Whether you try to dissect Psalm 22 or not, Jesus felt a huge sense of abandonment on the cross. Now, there are so many interesting things that we can take from this. The one thing is this, that even to the end, right to the end, people, probably the Jews standing around the cross, still had this political idea of the Messiah in the back of their mind. The fact that, oh, Elijah, he's calling Elijah. And the Jewish expectation to this day is that when Elijah comes, then the wrath of God will be poured over the enemies of Israel, the persecutors and the oppressors of Israel. So he's calling on Elijah. Maybe it's time now. So they're still expecting this political Messiah to overthrow Rome. But Elijah does not come, and Jesus is just another failed Jewish Messiah. And he's there in the company of so many other failed Jewish Messiahs. Just another guy who tried to overthrow Rome, but alas, Rome overthrew him. Now, it's interesting that in early Christian Jewish dialogue between Justin Martyr and some of his Jewish contemporaries, the Jews will admit, these Jewish apologists, they will admit that Jesus was impressive, he might have performed miracles, that's all fair, but you cannot be crucified under Pontius Pilate and be considered the Messiah of the Jewish people. That is not how God wins. The Messiah was supposed to defeat Rome. He does not die on the cross. It's as simple as that. But then we read, with a loud cry, Jesus breathed out his last breath. And with that, now here we need a little bit of imagination. He cries out. It's almost as if that last cry was his death. He didn't cry and then he died. It was almost as if that last shout was his death. Centurion, this battle-hardened, professional pagan killer, standing at the foot of the cross, looks up and says, "Surely this was the Son of God." And that's a loaded term, because Augustus was God. Tiberius, who's currently in charge, currently the Emperor of Rome, is the son of the deified Augustus. So he is the Son of God. So when the centurion is saying Jesus is the Son of God, he is basically saying Jesus is king and Caesar is not, Tiberius is not king, he's not the emperor, he's not in charge, Jesus is. What is ironic though is the fact that here you have this Roman centurion acknowledging that this is the Son of God, and here you have other people saying, oh, Jesus is just another failed Messiah, he did not conquer Rome. But he did. But in a very subversive way. Here's a centurion, this, again, battle-hardened pagan guy fighting for the emperor. He confesses that Caesar is not king, but Jesus is. Jesus is, in fact, conquering the centurion. He is, in fact, convincing the centurion, but not by the spear, not by killing them, not by overthrowing them, but by being overthrown, by being killed. By sacrifice, he is conquering Rome. And, I mean, we know the rest of the story. We know how the Roman Empire ends. We know how Christianity just spreads through the Roman Empire like a very, very good virus. And Jesus did eventually conquer Rome, but in a very subversive way. Here's the question, though. What is it that convinces the centurion? It's not a miracle. It's not him, because remember, this centurion was probably part of the guys who mocked him earlier, who would blindfold him and slap him in the face and say, "Oh, please prophesy." Who mocked you? Oh, who mocked you? Who slapped you in the face? Who did that? And Jesus didn't do anything. That wasn't what convinced him. Some might say it was the earthquakes or whatever, but that's definitely not what Mark is interested in. So what is it that convinces this centurion that Jesus is in fact the Son of God? What triggers him? It's not a miracle, it's not a sermon, it's not Jesus explaining his ways, it's not Jesus explaining why he did certain things. It's just a cry, a shout, a loud scream. Yes, sure, you know, the last breath of God, of life itself, will be something. I think when God breathes out his last breath, that is something that can take anybody's breath away. But still, I think we should not try and rationalize this. It remains a mystery. It doesn't follow why the centurion was moved by this. But that is interesting, because perhaps the world will only consider that Jesus is in charge and not the virus, that Jesus is in charge and not money, that Jesus is in charge and not sex and not fame and not status and not some celebrity, when we as Christians for a moment cease to explain everything. We just lament, we just cry, we just scream. Maybe there is more of apologetic power in just crying and screaming and not necessarily answering and trying to rationalize everything. So for now, we're on Good Friday and we try to make sense of the cross, and it's very difficult, and we often just want to run towards the Sunday because that's resurrection. That's the story ends well. Yes, it's a happy ending, and we want to go there. But the nice thing about Easter and this whole process and this whole liturgy is the fact that it deliberately slows us down. And wherever you are now, you are not allowed to run to the resurrection. I want to invite you, the church wants to invite you, to slow down, to really look at this Good Friday, or more appropriately, this terrible Friday, coupled with a virus, really slows us down, and we are stuck. We are stuck. We are locked down. But I do think that it is a holy type of stuck that we find ourselves in. And it is something that we should embrace, as a matter of fact. The Franciscan priest, Richard Rohr, recently wrote this, and I think it's something good to meditate on for this Good Friday. We are in the midst of a highly teachable moment, he says. There's no doubt that this period will be referred to for the rest of our lifetimes. We have a chance to go deep and to go broad. Death is being forced on us by great suffering, which, as I like to say, always leads to great love. But for God to reach us, we have to allow suffering to wound us. Now is not a time for an academic solidarity with the world. Real solidarity needs to be felt and suffered. That's the real meaning of the word suffer, to allow someone else's pain to influence us in a real way. We need to move beyond our own personal feelings and take the whole. Our feelings of urgency and devastation are not exaggeration. They are responding to the real human situation. We're not pushing the panic button, we are the panic button. And we have to allow these feelings and invite God's presence to hold and sustain us in a time of collective prayer and lament. So I want to encourage you not to go immediately into this rationalizing mindset on this good but terrible Friday. Do not go into a sentimental mindset where the cross becomes something fluffy or nice or whatever. Stay in the absurdness of this. Lament. Maybe reflect on Psalm 10. Lord, why do you stand so far away? Why do you hide in times of trouble? Or Psalm 13 that says, Lord, how long will you continually forget me? How long will you hide your face from me? Or Mark 15 that says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Let's use the rest of this day and really properly embrace this beautiful biblical tradition that God himself embraces, the biblical tradition of lament.